Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's April 14th, 2019, and welcome to episode 191 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I'd like to know. Will I ever
RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and maximum capacity, or something like that, I don't know. Anyway, I'm Paul Hagstrom in Boston, and I am joined by a crowd of retro computing enthusiasts. First among them, Carrington Vanston in Toronto. How are you, Carrington?
I am first among them, and I am a crowd of retro computing enthusiasts. Look at me, I'm doing good.
Excellent, excellent. I don't know who to go to next, so I will go to Earl Evans. In Portland, how are you doing?
Hey, Paul. I'm great. I have personally reached maximum capacity. So
excellent. All right. We will burden you with nothing further. And then, moving over to Stockholm, we have Jack Nutting. How are you?
Hey, Paul. I'm doing okay. I was sick for a whole week, so we'll see how much I can get through this without coughing and making horrible throat noises to everyone.
Well, I hope you leave your microphone on so we can close off the episode with just coughing and horrible throat noises.
You can do a super cut of just all the coughing.
Yes, that'll be excellent. Well, okay, so fishing around a little bit for sort of host topics, Blake wrote on the Byte Seller a pretty interesting topic. He wrote, let's talk about capacitor failure. And I think this is a good thing to kind of focus on, just because I think there's interesting things to talk about, and there's some amount of expertise amongst us, and it's good to sort of just bring it to a wider audience as well. So on Blake's post, he wrote, one thing that comes up fairly often is the failure of capacitors. And so what he writes is that you know, some of his computers are nearly 40 years old, and in all the time that he's been collecting vintage computers, past 20 years, he's never, not once ever, replaced a single capacitor. And he says, I would like to continue on as I have always done, using the systems as is, with the plan of replacing capacitors on a given system in the future as they inevitably fail, but he just wants to know how risky that is. So there's actually some really pretty useful comments going through the different kinds of capacitors and so forth. And Blake also wanted people to, you know, chime in as well with their own experiences. There's quite a few comments there on his blog on ByteSeller.com, but it was actually also picked up by Hackaday, you know, sort of inspired by Blake's post. And then there's a bunch of, like, 65 comments on the Hackaday article as well. So I think this is definitely something people want to talk about, and it's something that I want to talk about, too. I basically have been just sticking my head in the sand on this, but I'm curious to know, like, what we think. So, and I think there are at least a few people who have here around the table that have stories about this. Maybe we can actually start with Earl's story about this.
Well, I'm kind of like you, Paul. I have had my head in the sand also with respect to replacing capacitors, or as the abbreviation goes, recapping the machines. I haven't ever done it, and I understand the need. And now I am a believer, because I got an Apple IIgs, always wanted an Apple IIgs, thought, this is going to be so much fun to play around with. Plugged it in, was using it for a while, when all of a sudden, this kind of hissy pop sound happened that I'd never heard before, followed by the most noxious, stinky, unbelievably horrible odor in like the history of ever. It was so bad. Now, interestingly enough, and we'll probably cover this as we go forward, it was not a catastrophic failure in the sense that the machine actually kept running. And I believe it's a filter capacitor, wasn't an absolute necessity in the power supply, from what I understand. But you obviously can't run it like that because, I mean, this was worse than a smoke bomb. I had to open the windows in my house. I had to use the infamous box of baking soda to try to suck up the odor over time. I'm lucky, though, in that it didn't destroy the computer when it blew, but it was an eye-opener, and I want to now, I think, get a bit more proactive with some of my machines, replacing the capacitors, or in some cases, like for instance with the Apple machines, I think Reactive Micro, and they may not be the only ones, sell replacement power supplies, like modern drop-in replacements for the Apple computers, and I don't know. I might go with something like that, or I might just recap the old power supplies, but having now had this happen and having to suffer the horror of it, I'm a believer.
Yeah. Yeah, I live in fear of that happening because, of course, most of my computers are in my, like, work office. And I can imagine that actually the, you know, the other people who share that space would not be too keen on this smell.
They would not. I could describe it best as a combination of tire skids and burnt marshmallows. I mean, it's just ridiculously bad. I can't express to you how horrifying the smell was. I mean, seeing the smoke was bad enough, you know, letting out the magic smoke being the catchphrase that we always use. And, you know, I always thought about, ha, 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 it's not funny.
Let's be serious, people. Yeah. So, Carrington, you said you have succeeded in replacing some caps, right?
I have indeed. One single time I recapped a motherboard. It was an LC3, an old Macintosh LC3. And it was not that big of a deal. There were, I think, something like 10 or 11 capacitors on the motherboard. And everything was spread out kind of nicely. Like I went in, and really all you're doing is snipping off a piece and soldering on a new thing. You just got to make sure, like I bought it as a kit. I went online and you could buy, I've just found a site. This was a few years ago. I found a site that just showed you a picture of the motherboard and said, like, these are the capacitors you'll need and click on this PayPal link and we will send it to you in a baggie. And that's exactly what I did. And so it showed up and here's your like 10 capacitors. And there were three or four different sorts. So I just had to make sure I put the right one in the right place. But it was really simple. Like just using basically a printed out photograph of the motherboard to tell me, put, you know, this one here and put this one here. And it wasn't a big deal. I looked once into recapping a power supply. And I just ran away screaming from it because, like, I opened it up and there was something like 7 or 8 capacitors there, and they were all jammed into like a 3-centimeter square. It's like, come on, there's just no way. So what made this not too bad was there were like 4 up in the one corner, and then the rest of them were spread all over like tons of room. And you just have to make sure you don't start, you know, dropping solder all over the board and saying, hey, welcome to the new trace. What do you think of this? So like, as long as you were super careful, it wasn't a big deal. And I think I got lucky in that, like, in particular, the motherboard I was recapping was like relatively large and relatively easy and didn't have 1,000 things to do. So it wasn't really that big a deal. It's not something I would be afraid to do again, having just, you know, I dived in once and it worked. So maybe I got lucky too, because my soldering is ugly. Anyone seen me solder would go, wow, that actually worked. And yep, if I could do it, anybody could do it.
Yeah, no, that's my concern. It's like, I was never a soldering person. I have put a couple things together. I intended to put more things together, but I mean, like, it just, I don't know. It always makes me want to take a nap whenever I think about this. But
well, just the key was, like, I have one of those little arms that like has a little magnifying glass and will pinch and hold things for you. And so that was it. You just, like, you're basically snipping out the capacitor. You hold the new one in place and you just, like, touch it with the soldering iron, then pull that away, touch the solder there, and bingo, it's attached, and just be really careful. And it wasn't that big a thing. And I was fortunate in that I was proactively doing it. Like, it was a computer that was having some trouble. I thought maybe it was the capacitors, though everything looked fine, and I just replaced all the capacitors. It still had the exact same trouble. Turned out to be bad RAM. Put new RAM in, and it worked fine. So cool. I recapped it for no reason, but it still worked after recapping, so I think that's pretty good. But that was it. So having done it once, I would do it again, and I would recommend others too. Just make sure you go and, you know, don't just assume you can look at it. Like, I can't necessarily tell capacitors apart. So buying it as a kit and being told, here they are, and they came with little, like, color-coded baggies, and it said, you know, the pink baggy stuff goes here, and the green baggy stuff goes here, and just followed instructions, and it, you know, no more. It was like Lego with a bit of heat. Not that difficult.
Yeah, that's promising. Because I know, I mean, so the kind that you were replacing, I think the thing about those is that they leak, right? So that particular type,
they look like little tubes.
Yeah. Defective electrolytic capacitors.
Okay, yeah. The kind that look like shrunk down little batteries. Like, imagine if you had a AAA battery, but it was now, you're going to scale it down to 1/4 size. That's what these all look like.
Right. I think some of the ones that need replacing are also like little, I don't know what.
Well, sure. Yeah. Oh, there were ones that had the black on the side, and then there's the little ones that just look like a little silver disc or the top part of a top hat kind of. But they're all just little right. things
it's like
with
the Monopoly
two leaves sticking out. Well, kind of, yeah. Like, it's other than the fact that they're small and you got to get under them. And mine at the end were all leaning all over and looked ugly, but worked fine.
Yeah. But so from what I understand, the stuff that leaks out is eventually corrosive. I mean, it's not like battery acid, but it can ruin things, and it can certainly cause connections where there shouldn't be connections. And so I think things like the classic Macs of like the SEs and SE30s and LCs and, you know, all those. And I think Next also and the Apple IIe card all suffer from these, you know, have these on them and will leak at some point. And I have so many of these to worry about that. That's why I was kind of thinking that I would like to, at some point, to just like take a week and just do them all, you know, buy.
It seems like a thing that somebody could set up a station at Kansas Fest.
Yeah.
Like, instead of doing a soldering lesson, let's do recapping.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now, so, it, you know, when you think about that, you can go down the rabbit hole on this because that's the other thing that scared me about the whole recapping thing is that I've got a bunch of computers, and if I want to recap a lot of them, you know, first off, you need a soldering iron that's decent. Mm-hmm. And so I did get that. I have a Hacko soldering station that you can set the temperature and yada yada yada. It wasn't too expensive, but
people love those too.
Yeah, it's really nice, I gotta say. But, you know, but so there's $80, $90, $100, right? And then if you watch the YouTube people who do a lot of this work, they will get a desoldering station as well. The thing that combines
a little solder sucker.
You know, it gets a little more advanced than that, right? It's just like you kind of a touch, click, psh, you know, the suction pulls it in. Very nice looking. I mean, you watch these folks and they can do a whole bunch of desoldering really fast, but then you've spent a whole bunch more money and you need more space to store this stuff. Pretty soon you need a whole workbench, and then, hey, why not buy an oscilloscope? I mean, at some point, you know, that is just what I'm thinking, that you start to go down the rabbit hole on this, and maybe as retro collectors, it might be a skill set and a set of equipment that we're eventually destined to have if we want to keep this stuff running.
Whereas I went the other way. Like, I don't have any of that stuff anymore. I used to have my own soldering gun, all this. I don't have any of that equipment. If I was to recap something again, I would have to purchase everything again from scratch. I don't have anything to do any of this.
Yeah.
Or would you look for, like, maybe a local makerspace?
Or you go online, and when you're buying it on eBay, you look for the words recapped.
Yeah.
And I buy one where someone else has already done it. I'm willing to pay you for your time. Welcome to being an adult.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's the thing that, you know, it's kind of frustrating about this is that, it's like batteries, you know, you don't have the option of really leaving it, at least with these capacitors that leak. You don't really have the option of just like leaving it in its original state, because it's going to destroy itself. I don't necessarily want to hand. I know I have a bunch of SE30s that I'll do, or SEs and things that do the grid pattern, that just is an overt indication of the fact that these things need to be dealt with. I think I have a portable too that's got. I really have to do something about this.
So time works both for and against us, because if you graph it out and over time, the number of computers that will destroy themselves due to not being recapped is going to go up and up and up. But the cost of a 3D printer that can print at like the 7-nanometer space to create a whole motherboard from scratch is going down and down and down. Right now it's infinite, but eventually there's a point where these two meet. And if it meets in my lifetime, then I can just say, who cares? I'll just 3D print a whole new computer from like base materials and atoms, and I will be a god amongst retro computers. That's what I'm hoping for. I'm holding out for that. What do you think?
Solid plan. Just let time take care of it.
Exactly.
Well, and I mean, I guess so. There are also there's a couple different capacitor uses, right? I mean, so the kind that are in the power supplies, I think, are mainly just sort of like smoothing out the current or something. So that's why you can run without them. Like if you're really worried about them exploding and making terrible smoke, you can just cut them out.
Well, there's another factor here too, right, which is expense. I'd be curious to know, Carrington, what you paid for the nice kit that you got to replace the ones for your Macintosh. And also I'd point out, if I'm remembering correctly, the bigger electrolytics and things like that you'll find in power supplies, they're not terribly cheap. I mean, if you start to replace a bunch of these things, it seems like you're going to be paying some moolah.
I think I paid like $50. It wasn't a ton of money, maybe even less than that. Like, it was a thing where just online there was a few sites selling them as kits. I don't have a link, but I've been looking to see if I got my old links, but I don't. Presumably the stuff all still exists. I found a site now called maccaps.com,
right,
but doesn't seem to actually sell them, but has the same sort of photograph that I was provided, where it links like, here's the photograph and here's where they go and here's the list of the capacitors you need. I just wanted to get it all in like one-stop shopping. I just went online and found a kit. And so probably what I searched for. And so it was just like, here, we'll just send it all to you. I'm like, good. I don't want to take a chance. Just I'll buy it from there.
Yeah. And I think so. MacCaps, I believe, is I've forgotten the guy's name. But anyway, he did an interview on Retro MacCaps at some point, and it was actually kind of a terrifying interview because he was sort of talking about just like how people are overestimating the ease with which this can be done. And there's a real risk of ruining your board if you don't do it right. And he actually has a service. These two things I just said may not be completely unrelated, but you can send him a board and some money, and he will fix it, and he will recap it and send it back to you.
I just found a Mac Plus capacitor kit, which is very similar to the thing that I got, and it's $20.
Yeah.
So everything seems to be in that kind of range. It's not a lot to buy these, but yeah, you're right. Like I could easily wreck this motherboard, but I thought it was wrecked anyway. I went in because it wasn't working. Like, well, how much worse can I make it?
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think, as a part of what I had thought, I have it one or two of these, capacitor kits as well. But part of what I was thinking was, if I really am going to do 25 of these things, maybe I should just go to Mouser or whoever it is that, provides these things originally and get my own, bulk set. Because, if I'm going to buy that many kits, I'm sure the kits themselves are way more expensive than buying the original things. But of course, when you buy them from James, whoever it is, Mouser or Jameco or whoever it is that sells these things, you have to buy a whole lot. So, but yeah, the idea of doing something like this at SolderFest, at something like Kansas Fest or VCF or something like that is tempting, but the idea of like then shipping all the like disassembling all the things and shipping all the boards to myself doesn't sound so great. So I don't know, Jack, have you had any experience with explosions or melted capacitors or anything?
I've had nothing that's gone wrong. I have had I had an old Sega Game Gear, this handheld game thing from the early 90s, and the display had gotten really, really terrible. Like, just everything looked wrong. And online, I got the idea to recap the thing, because that's from the period where there started to be this sort of, the plague of bad capacitors, right? Early 90s. Mm-hmm. So I did. So I got online, I found you know, some kind of component list on some website of what all the capacitors were in this thing. I found a local supplier in Sweden, like a mail order or online order thing where I could send away with these things. Got all the capacitors, changed them all, put it all back together, and it was just the same. Like, I didn't make it worse, but I didn't make it better either. So, like, I don't know. I guess the problem was probably the LCD screen, but at that point I just sort of gave up on the thing. But I was glad that I recapped it without breaking anything, without making it worse. And it wasn't too bad. It wasn't too difficult. Like, sort of like Kerrigan said, in this case, there wasn't a kit. I had to sort of find the pieces myself. But then once I had it, it was not a big deal, even though I didn't really have good equipment or anything. But I picked up a couple of interesting thoughts from the comments on Blake's blog post, one of which was there was someone who said, basically, that you should consider the risk of the capacitors you have on a board and the quality of the board itself. Like this guy was saying that, essentially, if you're just changing capacitors for the sake of doing it before they've gone bad, if the board itself is kind of bad, you run the risk of actually damaging the board. Like he mentioned specifically, like Atari XE computers that have kind of lousy PCBs. And so you run the risk of actually damaging it by changing a capacitor. And if the capacitor wasn't bad, then you've kind of, it's, you know, defeated the purpose and made things worse. Someone else, or maybe the same person even wrote that, like, most retro computers from the 80s and older don't have too big of a problem with this. Like, that most of the bad capacitors came a little bit after that and continued on into the 2000s, really, which I thought was interesting. And there are a couple of links in there also to this EEV blog on YouTube where they were fixing. One was an LCD display that was found in the trash, and they fixed that by replacing bad capacitors. And one was a huge plasma TV that they replaced capacitors on, and got, like, they fixed some of the problems with the TV, but not all the problems with the TV. But there again, they had like the great equipment. They're doing it in this lab and everything, and it's sort of really nice, fun to watch anyway. But the interesting thing I found on all of those was those were all like big capacitors, relatively big capacitors that were on power supply boards, as opposed to like little capacitors that are on a computer's motherboard, you know, near the digital circuitry. So I don't know. I don't really know what the pros and cons are, or the risks of doing it versus not doing it. To me, it's still kind of an open question. And I don't have a lot of retro hardware myself. I pretty much have a couple of old Atari systems that are all 1985 or older. And I have not recapped any of those and don't plan to right now. I don't know. Yeah. We'll see, I guess. I don't feel super worried about it. I feel a little less worried about it after reading Blake's blog post today and the comments, actually.
I can't say one of the risks is that you do it completely the wrong way, because during this discussion, I've been reading about the proper way to do this. Mm-hmm. And I completely soldered these all wrong. I can't believe it worked the first time I did. No wonder it was so ugly. Well, because you like take the old ones out, it's really easy. Heat it from the bottom, they pull out. But I didn't really think through, now that I've read instructions, that like the old solder joint there would be enough. Just heat it up and stick the capacitor down there, and it should flow around it and hold it. I was adding solder on every single one, which looks like is super risky, and that's why it was so ugly. Mm-hmm. Hmm. See, again, if I could do it, anybody could do it, because it looks like I just muddled through this and got lucky. So whatever. I don't think it's really as hard as people say.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and I would totally wait until something failed, except for the fact that, you know, except for the possible damage.
The leak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because
it's like with batteries, you don't want to wait to pull them out until they're leaking.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, I'm hoping that this summer I can really just go through basically everything and open it. I mean, you know, just make sure that everything that's scary in there is gone.
There must also be services where instead of having to go on and buy it, if you've already got, say, a computer that you'd want to get recapped, there must be services where instead of having to go and buy one that's already done or do it yourself, you can send it off to someone to recap it or do a board swap. I send you my old board, they send you a new or a recapped one, and they're just charging for the service and a bit extra or something. That must exist. So
well,
if you
Mac
don't
Caps
want to do it yourself,
that.
There's always a thing. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I even though it was easy, I think if I don't know, as you get older, you have more time, more money than time, right? So sometimes I'd rather just throw that as a solution, which I know isn't exciting, but Other people do things better than I do. Other people do almost everything better than I do.
Yeah.
This is a thing I have learned.
I'd sort of like to, I would like to be able to do it, but I don't necessarily need to be able to do it like 28 times.
Yeah, having done it once, I don't really want to make it like that a hobby or go into, if somebody else is really keen on it, I'm like, well then, you know, hey, I'm going to support your hobby and let you do it to my computer.
Right. But yeah, I mean, I guess, so, I mean, I suppose there's, you know, there's a lot more that we could say, but I would say definitely go read the comments, particularly the first few. Joe Zatarski wrote, like, I think 4 or 5 part comment, you know, right at the beginning of Blake's blog post, kind of outlining the different types of capacitors and like which ones to worry about and that sort of thing. And then, you know, look at the Hackaday ones. I think it's definitely worth absorbing the knowledge. And I don't think we can transmit that knowledge all that well from here, but definitely go look at this. Okay, so I will maybe mention now a couple of listener feedback things. So Tony wrote to point out a pretty interesting article that was published in the Spectrum, I don't know what Spectrum is, IEEE Spectrum, you know, like whatever, online publication, which is actually, I think this is an excerpt of a longer book about the history of IBM that's coming out from MIT Press by James Cortada. The Rise and Fall and Reinvention of a Global Icon. But it's an article about how building the System 360 mainframe nearly destroyed IBM, is what it's called. And it is kind of interesting. You know, maybe I haven't read every word of it, but it's sort of talking about the end of the IBM, whatever it is, 1404, I think. What is that machine? 1401. and the fact that they were just... the demand was sort of outpacing their capacity and sort of what the IBM was trying to do in order to deal with that. All the different factions within IBM and how it's just a miracle that this actually worked. There's some nice pictures of the production line where there, you know, people are putting the control panels together and stuff. And apparently they, at some point they doubled production capacity in order to try to meet demand and wound up, like, I think sending out something like, I don't know what it was, a 25% failure rate on these little solid logic technology modules. But anyway, whatever. It's interesting to see, you know, how close to failure this thing was, given that, you know, it turned into basically the mainframe everybody had. Anyway, take a look at that.
Cool.
Ben wrote on Facebook, we were talking, so on the last episode, I guess it was like a month ago now, we were talking a little bit about corded keyboards and things like that, and it reminded him of an article, or not an article, a video that had Alan Alda interviewing Thad Starner, who went on to work on the Google Glass, and in this interview, he was talking with Alan Alda and had this, like, really clunky looking, you know, kind of like 1996 era Google Glass thing on. Basically, it was a screen affixed to one lens of his glasses where he would watch. He would sort of have Emacs running, and then there was this at the same time, there's this thing he wrote called Remembrance Agent, which would kind of look at what's in the main Emacs buffer and then bring up documents and emails and things that were sort of related. And anyway, the thing that reminded Ben of this video was our discussion of the corded keyboard and the Twiddler is what they called. In fact, Carrington, I think you may have mentioned that name before, the Twiddler.
Sounds like a Batman villain.
Yes.
The Twiddler. Ha ha ha, twiddle me this, Batman. I'm waiting, he said, sitting there twiddling his thumbs.
The other joke is, Twiddler, I don't even know her.
Well done.
Thank you.
That's what she said.
Thank you.
Oh, God.
Anyway, yes. So but you can still get the Twiddler, and Ben sent a link to both a video excerpt and the Remembrance Agent, which at least did compile or still work with Emacs, at least as of 3 years ago. So I'm kind of curious about this Twiddler keyboard. There's a third generation of these out now. You can buy it from the official people for something like $200, and there's like one in stock or something. And apparently it's not, they're not super common, but I might kind of want to get one. I think I want to get a used one.
They come in a bunch of colors. Yeah.
It does look pretty cool, and I like the, there's like a bullet list of good things about it, the features of this, and the final bullet point is, you look cool using it.
Yes. Yeah, and that is the main thing.
Do you? But it's like the exact opposite of a device from Apple, because it's a little black handheld thing with buttons everywhere. Everywhere you can put a button, it's just filled on the top, on the front, everywhere. And it's like Steve Jobs is like, what? No, get rid of all of those. We'll just swipe and random thing happens on your Apple TV.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate the Apple TV one. Anyway.
But yeah, no, it's the Twiddler, it says it's designed for your hand. It's got four rows of three keys each.
What else would it be designed for?
Yes. Well, the idea is that it's, you know, like...
for your mouth.
The mouse is not, right? The trackpad is not. I would love to become capable of using this, but yeah, so anyway, each of your fingers has access to a row of three things. It's the... Some of the stuff is corded, and it responds to the releases, not the depresses of the keys, so that you don't have to hit everything at once. You just have to release them at once. Looks kind of cool. But then also the video too, it was Scientific American Frontiers, season 7, episode 1, Inventing the Future. And so there's a bunch of stuff in there talking about biofeedback and you know, various things. The Twiddler was in there, but also all these other things. I think it was basically Alan Alda walking around talking to people at the media lab and at MIT and stuff. And anyway, it's probably worth watching the entire hour-long episode as well. All right. Blake also wrote on Twitter asking how we could mention Beto O'Rourke and not mention the Apple II connection. He had an Apple IIe and ran a BBS, Taco Land. Also, Blake has opinions about the Sorest way to pronounce GIF, hashtag Sofga. You have to actually probably see the tweet in order to understand what I was doing there, but at any rate.
I think, didn't somebody else give feedback on Twitter or somebody, when it, just to get back to the QWERTY keyboards for a bit, saying they're still big with like court reporters?
Oh, yeah, stuff. Quinn did.
Yes. Yeah, because I have a friend, Cherry, who works as a court, they don't call it court reporter, court something.
Stenographer, maybe.
And also, maybe, yeah, and then also gets the transcriptions, you know, has to take them home and type things up. So she's been doing that for ages and completely uses this weird corded thing, like it's a tiny little piano keyboard in a sense that you press on that's super silent, obviously, because you're supposed to just sit there banging away, but absolutely looks like a teeny tiny little Phantom of the Opera just playing in the corner, and also uses foot pedals when you're doing transcription, and that's how it like slows down or speeds up. So it's this bizarro thing that I think once you get trained at, you're crazy fast. So she can transcribe things at much faster than real time. So if you give her like an hour long thing, it'll take, you know, 15 minutes to transcribe it or something, which is just bonkers to me.
That's amazing. Yeah. This is what she wrote, from Quinn on Twitter. I don't know why I didn't catch this, in my feedback roundup here, but yeah, she said, the courting keyboards are much more efficient. The learning curve is steep, and they found a niche in court reporting. Traditional stenotype keyboards are corded, and they can do 375 words per minute, which is amazing. I'm not sure that I think I remember thinking I was doing pretty well when I was somewhere around 80 or something, right?
Right.
Right.
But very cool. So Lane wrote an email asking about the back catalog of our episodes. And, of course, you know, whatever, they are of whatever quality they are. But wondered if we could make a torrent available, and we probably can. Although I think the way that would work most likely is that we would get them on the Internet Archive and then let the Internet Archive's automatic torrent creation thing do that.
We'll have a torrent when we set up our new site.
Yes, exactly. We've been talking for a while about trying to move to a different host. And
by for a while, you mean years.
Yeah.
Years and years.
Yeah. We are aware and not... You know, it's not exactly by choice that our RSS feed only goes back, you know, however many episodes it does, but it doesn't go back all the way. And I don't, you know, I assume that's some sort of like resource thing, you know, that if we were some mega popular podcast and everybody was trying to download the RSS feed that had everything in it, then that could be problematic. But
well, also just foolishly, when the site got set up the very first time, it was set up using the inbuilt RSS creation thing, basically create a blog in there, because versus using a separate, you know, feed burner or whatever. And so it's just tied the two together, which is part of the hassle of moving to a new host. And we'll just clean it all up at that time.
Yeah. So if If everyone is lucky, then they will be told, you have 190 new episodes on the RCR feed. We're hoping we can avoid that. But no,
we're going to redo all the episodes.
That's right.
Transcription style. We're just going to like play each other's roles.
Oh, look at this.
The role of Paul will be played by Carrie.
Actually, and looking down my little list of feedback, I did, in fact, have Quinn's comment there. So that's good. I'm glad
I could actually look at the notes while we record, but you know, it seems like a lot of work.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, let's see. Maybe I'll say one more thing, another Blake thing, which is that the July 1984 issue of the A Plus magazine, which is like a Apple-centered, used to be Apple II and then moved on to, I think, partly to do Mac stuff. But that's where he heard of the Mother of All Demos first, because there's a big article on that. The origin of the mouse basically was the idea. But so it actually has a pretty cool picture of like this wooden mouse. Apple's popular little rodent has an intriguing history and shows inventor Douglas Engelbart like looking at this block of wood. It looks like a, you know, whatever, pine car derby or pine, what do you call it? Pine wood racer.
Right.
Car. It's a very weird little thing. But anyway, so if you want to see the original wooden mouse in color, there's an A-plus issue that has this.
A-plus is one of those magazines I have a strong association with that probably some of you guys and some of our listeners do as well. For many years, if you bought a Macintosh, one of the things you would get along with your stickers and the warranty card and such was an offer for, I think, half a year, like a 6-month subscription to your choice of a few different magazines, one of which was A-plus. And so those came with computers for a long time. Long past the magazines stopped existing. I remember getting computers like, how can I check off a subscription to like A+? A+ hasn't existed for 2 years. And I always thought I should send them in, but I didn't. But that's one of those weird Apple quirks where for a long time, at least in Canada, you would still get those cards offering subscriptions to magazines that were no longer in existence.
All right. So now I'll move on to the items of interest and news part rather than the feedback part. And I will hand it over to Carrington.
Oh, I got a fascinating one. Absolutely. So imagine, I'm going to paint a word picture for you. Imagine you go to a big old swap meet. And so it's out in a parking lot and there's tons of like old gear just laying about and old televisions, old computer things, old radios. And then nestled among all the old televisions is this wooden box, like the size of a small toolbox, just a box with a lift up lid and a latch. And on the side of the, totally unlabeled, side of the box, you see there's a DB25 port and an on-off switch and a switch to go between full and half duplex. Now, if you're listening to this podcast, you probably go, well, that sounds like a modem. If it goes for full and half duplex, what else would it be? And it was indeed a modem. Specifically, this article says it was a Livermore Data Systems acoustically coupled modem from around 1965. And the person who spotted the box recognized it for what it was, which turns out to be a super rare modem. He writes, the probability of knowing what an acoustically coupled modem looks like is inversely proportional to knowing what Fortnite is. So I thought
right.
That was
sounds about right, because I'm not quite sure what that is.
Exactly. Now, what's cool about this article is it said a bunch of things that I kind of vaguely knew, but really, I guess it never gelled in my mind. A lot of us probably know that for many, many years, like if you go back to the 1930s, 1940s, you were not allowed to connect anything to the phone system. It's AT&T system, you're renting your phone, you're not allowed to connect anything to it. And it turns out there was this act in 1934. Up until then, it was illegal to attach anything to a phone in your house, anything at all. In 1956, this changed with there was a court decision when there was the Hushaphone Corporation sued the United States to say, well, this is ridiculous. And the courts ruled that you could mechanically attach something to your phone's headset. Like you could physically have something touching a phone, but you could not touch like the network. You could never electronically connect anything, which is essentially why for many years, up until like 1978, you had acoustic coupler modems. So we all remember from like the 90s, or you get the V56 modem, whatever, and you just take your phone jack and you plug it into this modem. But when you're doing that, you're electronically connecting to the network, which before 1968, but I guess the tariffs were only in place by 1978 or something. So before the late 70s, that's why you had acoustic coupler modems, because you're technically doing this workaround. You're not electronically connecting, you're physically touching a thing that's going to happen to shout at your phone. And that's essentially why you have acoustic coupler modems. I did not really know this, and I found that really fascinating. So this particular modem is quite interesting because it's from like 1965 or so. So it's in that period where you cannot electronically connect things, but it's designed to use an acoustic coupler panel, but could really work without it if you are. It's a very forward-thinking modem. It's just kind of neat. So mostly I'm linking to this article because the modem's neat and the person does a full teardown. And then it's talking about, like, would it make sense to really do a rebuild of this, of getting it working again? Because like we've often talked about, what do you really do with a modem anymore? But this is an interesting little piece of history, and it's a very, very early modem. And while it didn't come with the acoustic coupler that it would normally work with, the fellow who wrote this, whose name I don't know, I keep saying, Brian Benchoff. He says, you know, he could 3D print an acoustic coupler, because again, the whole point of that is just act like a little speaker couple and let this thing shout at your phone. So I found the history behind it really interesting. The write-up is fascinating. It's got great photos. So you want to see a very, very, very early modem from the mid-1960s and talk about having a whole bunch of things that, like, you wouldn't want to have to desolder and put back in. It is densely packed, but really interesting. And was an interesting doorway into kind of the history of modems and the reason really why acoustic coupler modems took off and were the thing. And it turns out it was just a big workaround. And that's something I never knew before. So I'll have a link to the article in the show notes. You can see lots of pictures. And I thought it was very cool. So how about you guys? Did any of you really know that that was the whole point of an acoustic coupler modem? It was a jury rig thing, like a workaround to the idea that you're not allowed to electronically connect?
I did not.
I thought it was just like the best we could do at the time. Yeah, it turns out, no, absolutely. They had the ability to just plug stuff in, but just it was illegal to do so. They said, well, then, okay, we'll plug into this other thing that looks like an inverted phone, and then we'll shout at your phone. There. How's that work for you?
I mean, it is true that you know, the phone, the earlier phones did not have these, like, nice modular jacks. They were, you know, like, the wires were screwed in, you know, under a housing. So it wasn't.
But you weren't allowed to do anything, like cut a wire and get, like, you right. could not electronically connect because it wasn't your network. The idea was, no, it's their network. They're really controlling it. You're renting the phone. You're renting everything. You're not allowed to touch it. We're just giving you a service. And it's funny how so many things nowadays go more and more toward that. And this is something that started that way and then moved toward more openness. And look at all the wonderful things that came of it. So hooray for that.
And now they're all gone.
Like, I remember as a kid that you couldn't even move a phone from one room to another without having someone from the phone company come and do it for you. Because, you know, like Paul said, like, there were no modular jacks in the 70s that I recall. Maybe later on, but especially earlier on when I was little, like, phones were just, like, essentially fixed to the wall. Even if they were on a cord, they were...
Sure, why would you want to walk around with a phone anyway? Like, where would you want to go?
Yeah, where are you going to go? But I guess I knew it was kind of a workaround, but I thought it was basically a workaround for the fact that, well, what could you plug in? Because there's no plug in the wall before a certain period of time. But what you're saying makes sense. Yeah, because it was actually illegal. I hadn't thought of it, but yeah, it was illegal to actually mess with any of that at all. So it makes sense.
I love, though, I read the whole thing about the Hushaphone Corporation, because that was they sued because they got the right to put the Hushaphone on, which was back when there were, like, candlestick phones. And the idea was this was like this little box you would stick over it that gave you privacy. Like, it's literally, we're just going to, like, put you inside this little box over a phone so you could speak into it. And it, like, you kind of spoke into this thing that would be around your phone to make it more private. And then that was illegal. They had to sue for the right to have that box because AT&T was like, no, you can't do that. You're putting a box over a phone. You'll affect our network. It's just totally ridiculous. And but I didn't know any, the whole thing is a really fascinating history that I was quite unaware of before.
Nice.
I watched a movie recently where somebody was in a kitchen talking on a phone, and this was a movie from the 70s. And so they had one of those super crazy long cords because, like, the phone was mounted in another room, and she's in the kitchen working and has like a 30-foot cord leading off to where it goes. Like, yeah, I'm old enough to remember super long cords on phones.
Yeah, I remember that. It was always, you know, you always wanted to have a little spiral thing that could reach to any point on the floor that it's on.
Mm-hmm. Well, because if you think about it, like the fact that the phrase cordless phone existed kind of implies, well, I guess before that it was just cords all the way down. Yep.
You have another sublink.
Just another thing I kind of stumbled on Hackaday when I was reading the first one. We'll just have a quick link to that one. The Neon 816, which is a 65C816-based mini TX motherboard. So it's being developed. So it's just like fit in a mini TX case or whatever, and it's a motherboard, but based around the 65C816 chip, which is kind of neat. So that's a chip I like, and it's going to have, ideally, going to have Atari-style joystick ports, but also like HD audio out. And so it's kind of bridging the two things, where you've got lots of outputs, but some retro output things too, and base it around a 16-bit design. So kind of neat. So if you want a higher-end 6502 thing, which is essentially what this is 16-bit version of it. It's a neat little motherboard in the making, so I'll have a link to that as well.
Weird.
Yeah, it's really cool. I joined the Facebook group for that. I've been watching the updates, and it's so much fun to watch actual engineering in progress, especially when you can tell there's a lot of enthusiasm behind it. I mean, the person who's developing this is really making a lot of progress real fast on putting these pieces together, and it's fun to see.
Yeah, I should follow along with this as well. Very interesting. I don't have anything I want to make for it, but I always kind of like the idea that I can, you know, like this stuff that I learned when I was in, you know, whatever, sixth grade, I can still use.
Mm-hmm.
So, excellent. All right, Earl, it seems like we are very maker-oriented this episode, but what's your thing?
Yeah, I was going to say, speaking of making things, so there is a set of boards that apparently you can buy now called RetroShield, and they bridge between an Arduino Mega and some various retro CPUs, including the 6502, the 6809, and the Z80. It seems like the most progress of the software that comes along with this is on the 6502 side, but there's also some fun stuff for the 6809. So just backing up a little bit, if you have a 6502 chip or a 6809 chip, that's great, but it won't run all by itself like a microcontroller chip. It needs RAM and ROM and some other support chips and a clock and some other outboard circuitry basically to get the chip to function. I mean, it needs kind of a universe around it. So what this project does, I think is really innovative, is it uses an Arduino Mega to simulate the universe of support chips that you need to actually make that CPU function. And the beauty of that is you buy the board, you buy an Arduino Mega, and you put the two together, and you've got something that you can do a little bit of something with. You can program some things in assembly language. You can jump to an assembly language monitor and learn about the chip. Or I think on the 6502 one, there's even an Apple I compatible ROM program that is up on GitHub. That means you can not just do assembly language stuff, you could also use the BASIC interpreter and play around with that. Now, it doesn't run very fast. If I'm reading it right, I think the clock runs at 97 kilohertz, maybe, instead of 1 megahertz. Yeah, it's pretty slow. But on the other hand, if what you're doing is just trying to learn about the chip and how the chip functions at a real basic level, then you're not trying to do a bunch of number crunching and other things like that. You're just experimenting. And so this gives you a platform to do some experimentation. At least the 6502 uses what they call memory mapped I/O, meaning if you want to read and write to an I/O device, you just write to an area of the 64-bit address space So another thing they say you can do with this cool project is do your own thing. Just hack in some code on the Arduino side that listens and or talks at a specific memory address, and you could make your own like little virtual peripheral for this. So it's just really neat. And the boards weren't that expensive. I think assembled, they're $28. So you get that, you get a chip, and kind of away you go.
That's cool. Yeah. This like, what I need is another project, but this seems like a fun one.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I need another project like a hole in the head. But, you know, I have wanted to do something that is a single board computer, and I could see this being a strong contender because it's inexpensive, and a lot of the other projects that I've seen out there in the single board computer world are just, they're just going to take too much time or too much hacking or whatever. This kind of makes it more simple. So I might actually spring for one of these. But anyway, I thought they were neat. I don't obviously have any information on how they are actually in real life. Like if you buy one, you know, how well do they work or anything? I don't know. They're real new too. So I think it's kind of early to have people have a lot of experience with them yet. Oh, by the way, I should point out Tony sent in the link to this as a feedback article, and thanks, Tony.
Yeah, and while you were saying that, you reminded me of something else. So you were saying, you know, this chip runs at something like 95 hertz or something, 95 kilohertz.
Well, kilohertz.
Okay, at least.
yeah, at least it's in the thousands of hertz.
It reminded me of Charles Mangan has been working recently on an Altair 8800 emulator that runs on an Apple II. And I was thinking, well, maybe we could run this on a, maybe we could adapt it to run on the Apple I emulated on this Retro Shield. But the Altair 8800 thing is actually pretty cool in and of itself. He's been working on trying to get like CPM to run on it and stuff like this, you know, emulated within on Apple II. It's quite insane, but pleasing.
Well, you could do it. I mean, kind of, isn't there a law or a rule or something like that, that on any Turing-complete machine, you could emulate basically any other Turing-complete machine? It just might be really super slow.
So, Doom will run very, very slowly.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and, you know, obviously also given enough space and that, but emulating an 8080 on a 6502, yeah, that's not going to run fast.
Particularly if it's on an emulated 6502.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so my thing is another person building, you know, electronics and with chips and things. So this is an article about building a homebrew video game console. I mean, it's interesting because it's super detailed about every step of the process. It's completely its own little unicorn. I mean, so this is Sergio Vieira, and a Portuguese guy who grew up in the 80s and 90s, always been nostalgic toward retro gaming, he says. So he just wanted to build from scratch a video game thing. So he you know, built up a breadboarded, you know, a bunch of stuff for video signal generation and for, you know, supporting controllers and doing sprites and... So he's, you know, what you end up with is this like board with a just tangle of wires that you program specifically. It's not compatible with anything else, but it's pretty cool, you know. So if you wanted to see, you know, he's got, you know, a nice little breakout game going, and I don't know if anyone else is ever going to write software for this or if it's just going to be him writing software for himself. but if you wanted to see kind of like what kind of design issues come up if you're trying to do one of these things, he's got these little like block diagrams of the architecture, the little, you know, IO part and the video part and the CPU part and controllers and things. It's quite interesting, but I do kind of wonder if it's just him by himself.
It's still an amazing achievement, though. Looking at the wire wrap boards, it's like, oh my goodness.
Yeah.
But then I watched the little video of the little mini breakout game, and it's really good looking. I was like, holy moly, dude, you've made like a full-on retro console.
Yeah.
Like this is like a NES. Like, it's just so cool. And it was neat reading about how the first version of it, basically the in the PPU or whatever is where the graphics are. And like, that's it. There's no way to change those. So anything you write, better use the graphics that are stored internally. And if you want something different, well, it changes the firmware. And then you realize like how to have it read a certain part of RAM, and you can therefore upload the graphics to that. And just like, it was neat reading through it, mm-hmm. in all the stages. I was working at a way higher level than I am. It was quite impressive.
Yeah, no, it all looks cool. Very, very good.
Yep.
All right. Let's see. Who's next? Carrington, you are next.
Yeah, I'm sick of all this hardware stuff. Hardware is for people who are better than me. Let's go to software. In fact, let's go to software written in BASIC. In fact, let's go to software written in BASIC, and it's only 10 lines. Of course, it is the BASIC 10-liners contest for 2019, and the winners have been announced. I love this contest. Mm-hmm. It is so wonderfully accessible. It's just like, it's just in BASIC. It's, you got to write it using just a retro version of BASIC, and it's just 10 lines. Like, so nobody's stepping up with a 30,000 line program that you couldn't compete with or wouldn't have time to. And there's various categories. We've talked about before, everywhere from the lines have to be just 80 characters to, I think the highest is like 256 characters per line or whatever. So you kind of pick the one that you want to compete in. And most people, it seems, compete in the smaller, the 80 line one. They call it the pure or whatever. So anyway, it's really cool. So the winners have been announced. I only played around with a couple of these. My favorite of all the ones was Poke Pig by Kevin Sa- and it came in last place in its category, which is completely bafflingly wrong. I don't understand. People do not see the hilarity of Poke Pig. We talked about it earlier episode. I find it delightful. It is my favorite, but whatever. I guess it just tickles my particular fancy, but I dug it a lot. So there's, we'll just have a link to the webpage that basically is just a list of the winners, and then you can Google and find online. Like, you can download all these things and play with them or whatever. But it's cool. Love the contest. I think it's great. This is the third or fourth year this has happened, and hopefully it will continue on to next year.
Excellent.
Yeah, I keep meaning to enter, or think about entering, but I don't even get to that part.
I keep meaning to think about entering too.
Oh my gosh, this Poke Pig entry is so funny.
Right?
The essay here starts out, my third grade teacher hated me and told my mom that I would grow up to be a serial killer. And then, parenthetically, this turned out to be inaccurate. but, oh my gosh, what a fun-looking thing here. I have to download this and play it.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Although, this might be one of those things that you don't want to play on a pet, right? Isn't it quite possible to, like, you know, actually destroy your pet?
Oh, the killer Poke, yeah.
Okay, so I had one other thing that, you know, very quick, short little thing, which is, it is an IMSCI 8080 papercraft. So Rocky Bergen has been doing a number of really pretty interesting little papercraft projects, but this one, you know, this one, I love it. It's excellent. It's a, you know, it's the War Games IMSCI 8080 with a disk drive and a keyboard and a little, I don't know what the thing is in the middle. But it looks fantastic.
It's like a oscilloscope.
It does.
Or a display of some sort, yeah. I didn't even know there were floppy drives for the IMSCI 88.
Oh, let's go watch War Games again.
I thought those were all reel-to-reel and blinking lights. Is there actually floppies on that?
It's like over to his left or something like that. Like you see him actually putting a disc in.
That means I'm due. I should watch it again. I'm never gonna get through the challenges in Ready Player One if I don't have that memorized.
That's right.
And there's a good argument to be made that a papercraft IMSCI 8080 is, you know, 90% as useful as a real one nowadays. So, like, for a fraction of the price, you get almost all the usability.
If you just put like a titanium block or something inside, then it also has the paperweight properties as well.
Or you want to make a little stop motion video, Godzilla versus the IMSCI, right. And then this is much more crushable.
Excellent. Anyway, yeah, so this one is great. He's also got a bunch of other cool ones. So I think we've mentioned some in the past, but take a look around the site as well as this one. And I think that's it for our items of interest. A couple notes about upcoming shows. The VCF Southeast, I think we have not talked about it before, but it is imminent. It is April 27th to 28th in Roswell, Georgia. So if you are anywhere near there, go check that out. VCF East is coming up May 3rd to 5th, and CocoFest, simultaneous, is May 4th to 5th in Lombard, Illinois. The GORF, Great Australian Retro Technology Festival, has been canceled. So,
which is so sad because it has the best name of all of them.
Yeah. But I think they didn't meet the threshold of people registering for it to be sort of viable. But I believe that the other two Australian things, WASFest 12 and 12 o'clock maybe, and QFest 12 are happening. But
or maybe everyone who was going to go to GORF was eaten by a snake or something.
Yeah, right. I mean, they found some new breed of spider or something.
Mm-hmm. And CocoFest looks like this year is the 28th annual last Chicago CocoFest.
This could be it. This could be it. Kansas Fest coming up July 16th through 21st.
Oh, and the keynote speaker has been announced for Kansas Fest too,
yes,
right?
It is Mark Pelzarski. I think we mentioned that last time. Might be wrong. But
was it last time like a month ago? Was it announced?
I don't know. That is early? A good question. But yes, Mark Pelzarski.
Just in case.
The graphics magician guy. So
who will come with a cape and a top hat, as all magicians should.
So those are the things you can do in the summer. Also Fujiyama 2019 in Germany, a Atari gathering, August 26th to September 4th.
Which is also like a week long, yes, or something, like, yes, a crazy huge one that I somehow had never heard of before.
Yeah, I don't know if it had happened before, but
yeah, because there's photographs of the last couple of years, and they have a photograph which basically here's all the people gathering, and it essentially looks like a Kansas Fest gathering. It's massive. Right. Very, very cool.
So Jack, you should go. It's not that far away.
I should. I'm thinking about it. I'm thinking about it.
All right.
And it's not far. It's true.
That's step zero has been accomplished.
Thinking.
I guess with that, we can go to a word from our sponsor.
Watch what you can do with this Apple II personal computer and any color TV. You can store over 100,000 pieces of information and find a single piece instantly. You can print your own reports, talk to other computers and get information like Dow Jones reports, chart your biorhythms, teach your children math, improve your chess game. Physicians can use it to get continuing education credits, and there's lots more.
I'm really sorry, folks. The presentation should be running. I just installed my new operating system, Windows 95.
Try typing sysedit.exe.
Thank you.
Check your autoexec dot.
No, look at your config dot sys.
Thank you.
If you're looking for a computer that's easy to use, there's still only one way to go.
Get a Macintosh.
And we're back. All right, so the host's retro computing gift idea is next. And given the topic about the, you know, worrying about our various recapping our computers and that sort of thing, and in honor of Earl's exploded Apple IIgs power supply, the gift idea is a classic Apple IIgs cap, which is, it's got a sort of, I don't know if it actually is a real Picasso-style logo. I'm not sure if that actually ever existed for the Apple IIgs. It may well not have, but it is a Picasso-style Apple IIgs logo on a hat from 8-bit.
Yeah, we should point out the type of cap we're talking about here is not a capacitor, yes, but a baseball cap.
That's right. Of course.
It's not like a little logoed capacitor for you, yes, want to like be really styling inside your computer.
Although we did say that like the Monopoly top hat is a little bit like a capacitor. Mm-hmm.
But, and I mean, it has capacity, hopefully enough for your head. So
if you didn't want the 2GS one, there are several others. I don't know actually how to get a list of them. But if you reload and reload and reload, you will eventually see among the related products something you might want. But there's a Texas Instruments cap, there's a Lisa cap, there's a classic Wheels of the Mind cap, which is the sort of the Picasso-style logo for an education magazine that Apple put out.
There's a Clarice the Dog Cow. That's the one I would get.
Okay. How are you finding them?
I reloaded over and over and over again. And it says, like, when you're looking at one of the products on the bottom, it'll show four others saying here are related ones. There doesn't seem to be a way on the site to actually search or find a list. You just have to hope they come up.
There's a shop by category drop down above the cap, and then you can see all the hats.
Cheater.
That's cool. And you can look for, if you go to the shirts category, which for some reason I did, I don't know why, it shows you the pillows. So,
of course it does.
There's an Amstrad pillow. That's excellent, actually. These are nice. The Atari 800 XL pillow, Commodore pillow.
So that's a hint about the next three or four episodes, right, worth of gifts.
There's
going to be a lot of soft furnishings.
just a Beagle don't feed floppies to crocodiles shirt, which I actually, I always associate that with the 4AM Twitter account, you know, because that's the the avatar that 4AM has chosen. But on a Karateka shirt?
The avatar chooses you.
Whose is this? Do we know this person? I think we might, actually. Is this Javier's site? It might be.
Oh, could be. Okay.
But anyway, it doesn't matter. They're cool. So if you want a hat, you can get a Claris the Dog hat or a cap or
a shirt pillow.
Or an Amstrad pillow.
That you can wear as a shirt.
That you can wear as a shirt. Perfect. So go forth and purchase. And while you're going forth and purchasing those, we'll give you some more things to look at eBay. And Carrington, you have the first of these.
The first one is an auction that caught my eye. It's one of those ones where I have no idea if it's a good idea or the cost is good or whatever. It's just every once in a while an auction seems like tailored for me. And there's a few vintage computers that I adore that I had in the past that I have a soft spot for that would be on the short list of ones I would consider if I was to again have a couple of retro computers or just one. And one of the groups, if you narrow down like three computers, I'm often drawn to, or if I had to pick just one to have, they would be on the short list that I could make arguments for. And the three of them are the Macintosh SE, one of the first Macs I had, not the very first Mac I had, but the second Mac I had, and the first one that was super useful and that I just loved, and I still love that form factor. There's the LC475, either my favorite all-time Mac or really right up there on the list. I just adore it. And the Apple IIc, one of my favorite computers, period. And I love the 2C. This is an auction for a Mac SE, an LC475, and a 2C bundled together for $6.99 Canadian, selling from Canada with very cheap shipping to me in Canada. So I feel like I'm being catfished. Right. But it's
and
like,
they all work too.
It's like, wow. And they all work. You get a monitor with the two computers to take monitors. Everything's shown to be working. I was like, this is just a delightful little thing. And for $700, that's not much per computer for three nice looking working versions of these things. And you're going to get the mice and the keyboards and the monitors and all that. And I was like, this is a lovely auction. Like, I'm not actually going to pull the trigger on it, but it's just tailor-made for me. So I wanted to give a shout out. So if you are very similar to me in that you're trying to narrow down and you can't decide between these three, why not have them all for 700 Canadian and relatively cheap shipping? This person from British Columbia will send you all of them and you're good to go. So that is my first choice. And I have two. So this is the first one I picked.
One thing I would say about the one that you, this first one, is that if you look at the keyboard, I can't tell if there are two keyboards. There may be actually only one keyboard for the two Macs. But it's the 2GS keyboard. It's the compact one.
Which is
the
keyboard I adore. Good which keyboard, is like the best keyboard. If you're going to pick one, you pick that keyboard. Like everything. But the only downside to this maybe is the SE is not the hard drive version. It's the dual floppy version. Not a big deal. Easy upgrade. But it's a dual floppy Mac SE. But it's just lovely. And like for $475, which is a relatively costly computer to pick up, and then to also get a working SE and a working Apple IIc in it. It's not really a bad price for a buy it now, $6.99. So it was about $520 US.
I think the LC475 is the, I think it's the top end that can take the 2E card.
The 2E card. Yeah, exactly. So it's the same internals as the Quadra 605 or the Performa 475 and 476 and stuff. So it's the LC version of the 4 chip, but it's really good. It has that PDS slot. So you can put the Apple IIe card in it, and then you could then sell off the 2C because you've got your Apple. It's all just lovely. It's a good setup. I dig it. Anyway, there's that one. That caught my eye because it just seemed like it was for me. And then another one caught my eye. Every once in a while, you hear about particular, like kind of more esoteric monitors or peripherals, and then I just kind of add a search for them and then forget all about why I added a search for them. And I had added a search for this, I think they're pronounced Benq or Benq. BenQ? How do you pronounce the monitor brand? BENQ.
Jeff, I think.
Anybody know?
I say Benq.
Benq. So it's a Benq monitor, the BL702A, which is one of the monitors that I had taken note of and had an ongoing search for, and I had to look up why. And it was because the same thing that's called out in this auction. It's one of those monitors where you can plug a 2GS right into it and it'll just work fine. You have a little adapter, but it just works good. So it's from that early multi-sync monitor era where they can handle the early RGB signals and stuff, or the 15 megahertz or whatever the heck is the thing that makes it hard to plug a monitor into a 2GS and get a really great looking image out of it. So if you've got a 2GS and you don't want to shell out for the new Vid HD or whatever, but you're looking for a monitor, this is a good looking 17 inch monitor that you can just plug into a 2GS. It shows it in the auction, plugged into a 2GS, and you just have to have that little pin adapter thing for the cable, but that's it. You just plug it in. Now, it comes from Great Britain, so it's going to come with a power cord to plug into the power that's over there, but it is a switching power supply thingy, so you could bring it to North America and just have to get a different cable and it would plug in and work fine here. So it's one of those monitors that maybe somebody wants, like a 2GS monitor, and you don't want to use the little composite signal. You're looking for the good-looking stuff. Otherwise, why have a 2GS? A lot of people might not know there are certain monitors that you can just get and plug in. You can't go and buy them new anymore, but they do pop up on eBay every once in a while. And so this is one of those. And it's 90 pounds, which I think $120 US or something for a buy now. Yeah.
Cool.
Nice.
Yeah, it's cool. So it gives you a 17-inch monitor, 17-inch LCD for a 2GS. That's what I got.
Nice.
All right. Earl, what do you have? This looks interesting.
It is. I don't know exactly how I feel about this auction.
Right.
It's a PDP 8S, and the case is in good shape. The toggle switches are all intact. The inside looks very clean. There is apparently some paint chipping going on the front of it along the little orange border just above the flip switches.
Which is very sad, actually.
It is kind of sad. And the unit is listed on eBay for an initial bid of $26,000. Now, PDP-8s, I know that the cost has gone up, you know, somewhat astronomically over the last decade. I guess it would take a real deck collector to be able to say whether a $26,000 price tag is applicable for something like this. And so, since I'm not really in the PDP-8 collecting world, I'm not going to comment on that except to say $26,000 with a $45,000 buy it now is a lot of money. Mm-hmm. I will make one snarky comment, which is that if you're going to sell something and hope to get this kind of money out of it, please take some better pictures, because some of the pictures here look good and some of them are out of focus. And I just can't imagine out-of-focus photographs on something that I want to sell for multiple tens of thousands of dollars. Now, the provenance of the machine as it's described is pretty interesting. I don't know if this is documented or not in any way, but they claim that the machine was used as an engineering prototype at DEC. It shows on the back as having serial number 0, and I'm not exactly sure what that would mean. Maybe it is unique in having that number, or maybe all the prototypes got that number. Again, you'd have to be like a serious deck collector to understand what the significance of that is. But in any event, it's interesting. They say it was used as a prototype and that at DEC it was used to develop the language Focal, which I have heard of but don't know much about. And there are perhaps four different owners of this over time. They mention it was sold to McGill University, and I'm not sure where that is. Do you guys know where that is?
In Montreal.
It is indeed.
Very good. In 1969, purchased by a Canadian individual in 1979. Was that you, Carrington?
No.
Just curious.
But I did recap this computer.
I had an uncle who lived in Alaska, and I'm tangenting wildly here, but you know, often if you're on an airplane or whatever with somebody and they say, "Oh, you know, I'm from Texas. Oh, do you know, X?"
Exactly, because everybody in Texas and Alaska knows everyone else.
Well, Alaska is small enough that the answer often is yes, in a way that it is almost not in other places. But so I was just wondering if maybe Carrington, by virtue of being Canadian, would know the person who bought this.
You have spent more time in Montreal than I have, so no.
And apparently it was then purchased by the seller on eBay in 2003. So it's only had, you know, a handful of hops during its lifetime. They mentioned the circuit is virtually indestructible, and it's true, actually, that the way these things were engineered, they were pretty darn reliable. And they say it operated the last time it was turned on. They don't say when that was. They mentioned they've got some spare boards, service manuals, and all of this. I love the look of the PDP-8 and of the PDP-11s that have the toggle switches. Those are just so neat to look at. So I like this auction from that perspective. Wow, that's a lot of money. So if you are a serious deck collector, and if you're screaming at your podcast player right now, trying to, you know, let us know how off the mark I am, please email us some feedback and let us know what you think about this. And I actually might add this to my watch list just out of curiosity to see what happens. It's got 6 days left at the time of recording.
When you say deck collector, I keep hearing it as debt collector. Thinking, yes, if you're a serious debt collector, look into these people dropping $45,000 on early PDPs.
Right.
Because they're crazy people and probably owe somebody something.
Well, I know if you collect some of the old deck machines, you can yourself actually collect a lot of debt in that process. Mm-hmm. So, especially if you buy this one.
The only shame on this one is that peeling paint on the front, which is such a shame, because one of the main reasons to have something like this is the aesthetics. And the inside of it looks great, but that front panel with all that peeling paint is just a real shame.
The inside of all of these, you know, PDP type machines are, it's amazing how many little cards there are. So many little cards. Mm-hmm. And people know what they are too. It's amazing.
Well, there are databases that you can look up the deck model number. If you look at that photo top down, looking at the cards, you'll see that all of them have a letter and then typically four numbers after that. Some of them three numbers, but there are databases where you can find out exactly what that card is. And you're right, especially in the PDP-8s, there were a million of those little cards. If you look at more modern, like PDP-11 QBus machines, you might have 4, 5, 6 cards in there. This has approximately a million.
Right. Yeah. Anyway, very cool.
Cool.
It almost might be fun to just, you know, build a little replica case, because they look, I really like the look.
Well, I mean, Oscar Vermeulen, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, who, by the way, it was a real pleasure to meet at the VCF Pacific Northwest. Mm-hmm. He came over and was showing off the PDP-8 and the PDP-11, and it was fun to take a look at those machines. So there are replicas of these.
Oh, yeah, I own one, unbuilt, sitting under my desk.
Ah, yes, that's right. That's right. You and Michael both, right, have one of those kits. Yeah.
Maybe I'll bring it to Kansas Fest. I don't know. All right. I will move on to my crazy list of auctions, and I don't know if I'll do them all, but the first one I have is a double disc converter, precision disc converter tool. It is a little punch. You put a 3.5-inch floppy disk in it. It says it converts any 3.5-inch 1-meg double-density diskette to a 2-meg high-density disk by punching a hole in it. Yes. That's what it says.
And that automatically also means the media is, you know, magically validated for use on both sides. That is so cool.
How does anybody believe this?
Well, because for ages, floppies suddenly, like, if you punched a hole, they were magically double-sided. So I think people just realized, of course, if you can punch a hole in the right place, you can make a floppy disk into anything.
That's right. So, yes.
You could turn this into a 100 megabyte floppy if you just punched a sufficient number of holes in it.
Oh, man.
Oh, well. Anyway, yes. I mean, it is true that the detector as to what kind of disk you have put in there does rely on this second hole. And so, and I think, I believe it actually does kind of work, you know, but I believe it doesn't last. You know, so like if you are using old media, non-dense media for high-density uses, I think it will appear to work for a little while.
But I wonder if there was a time at which once the higher-density stuff exists, if I'm a manufacturer, I might just say, I'm just going to make that for all my disks, and you just if it'll work fine for the older ones. So maybe there was a period where if you bought a new, like a newly made floppy disk, you could punch it and it would be fine because the actual floppy media on the inside would work fine.
I think I remember hearing that, like, basically they made them all the same, and then the ones that were of lower quality when they tested them became lower density ones.
That makes sense.
Yeah. That's, I'd heard something similar.
Same thing happened to me in school.
That's right.
And I also got punched a lot because of it, so it's bringing back a lot of memories.
High density, Carrington. Yeah. Anyway, I thought it was an interesting little thing from the past. The next thing I have is I don't know if this is interesting or not. It is a General Magic Data Rover 840. So, Magic Cap thing. I think we talked a little bit about the General Magic...
General Magic, yeah.
The documentary. General Magic, the movie. It was basically a bunch of people who went from the Macintosh team, and they started their own company called General Magic, and they made a couple of these... I'm blanking on the name. I don't remember. What is the name of the thing that is before the Data Rover? The Data Rover is like the improvement on...
It was the Magic Link was the Sony thing, right?
Yes, it is. That is it.
I'm thinking all the Magic ones. So it's the Magic Link. And then there was the... Oh, wow. You think I would know this. It wasn't that long ago I watched that documentary.
Magic Link is it. Yes, Sony was manufactured this Magic Link thing. I don't think actually this may have been... Not manufactured by Sony, this Data Rover. But anyway, there were a couple of iterations of the Magic Link. And the Data Rover was kind of like the last one. It had, I think, the version 3 of the Magic Cap operating system. And apparently it was great, you know, in comparison to the other ones. I think it was sort of at the tail end of... It didn't take off in the market. This is an expensive item on eBay. It's like $200 starting bid, $260 to buy it now. But it looks like it's in good shape. It has all the accessories. Has a battery that probably is not something you want to use, but maybe you can recondition. It has, you know, the power supply. The thing is in pretty nice shape. And one of the things I actually like the best about this is that General Magic. It has space for two like PCM CIA cards, and it has a little like flip up screen cover and so forth, and it has a little connector. And the name of the connector, the General Magic peripheral connector, is the Magic Bus. So there's a little slot there that says Magic Bus. Very nice. I assume whoever thought about that, who thought of that first, caused the entire office to become singing. They were all singing Who songs.
Right up until they closed the doors at 3 o'clock that same day. But
anyway, yeah, I think it's pretty neat. I did get one of these just like a month ago or something like that. Not for this much though, and I haven't really played with it, so I can't review it. But I did notice the Magic Bus thing. I thought it was pretty cool. And part of the reason I was interested in it is because this is kind of like the last step, the best of the operating system, the best of the Magic Cap OSs. And it's really super elaborate. It's like it's the desktop metaphor, and you can go out in the hallway and. I don't know. You can sort of see the Macintosh, heritage there.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing is another thing from Sci-Fi Man in Nova Scotia. This is an ultra-rare Tulip System 1, which is somehow related to an Exidy Sorcerer. I don't know anything about it except that it's relatively unique. Exidy Sorcerer is one of those things that I've been kind of half interested in for a long time, but... have never found one within reach. Anyone have any Exidy Sorcerer tales to tell?
Nope.
Or Tulip System 1 tales to tell?
Or, no, I've never even heard of the Tulip. Nope. So it is ultra rare to me.
Yep.
It is to me, too. Never heard of it. I don't even know what chip it uses.
It runs on actual tulips.
I think we have talked about the Exidy Sorcerer before, and I think even when we talked about it before, we couldn't quite... figure out what chip it ran. I mean, like, it is certainly known probably by you, the listener, as you bang on your little headphones, but...
It's known by the people who are currently screaming at their players.
Anyway.
Oh my gosh, I just consulted the Great Wiki, and it says it was a 16-bit computer based off the Intel 8086.
All right. That was not going to be my guess.
Wowie.
That's interesting.
No.
Nope.
So, 1983... which puts it, you know, kind of in the solidly in the 8-bit kind of realm. and it could run a generic MS-DOS version 2. So really kind of a interesting system. And the picture that they have on Wikipedia is not as good as the picture that they have on eBay. It looks like the eBay one either was photographed better or is in better condition.
And things by the seller are not cheap, but they are interesting. This is a $500 buy it now. This is quite a collection. You know, we've been going through probably for the last like 3 months or something, the things that Sci-Fi Man has put up for auction. But they're all very interesting. You know, too expensive probably for any one person to get them all, but at any rate.
Well, also, you know, and I'm going to say again, because this is just my thing to say, I love it when they have a make offer button.
That's right.
Because, you know, I mean, you can put it at a high price if you want, if you give people the opportunity to make an offer, and then you can kind of see what happens. I mean, maybe you did overprice something, and then that'll let you know.
All right, let's see. The next thing I have is it's an HX20, typo-ridden title, so, you know, no one's going to find this. It's a...
That's how you get the deals.
It's Espen Portable X20.
The infamous X20, yeah.
But, so, you know, we've talked about the HX20 before. I'm not actually sure what underlying operating system it runs. I think it's sort of its own little thing, like not compatible with anything else.
Yeah, it's its own thing.
One of the things that led me to think this was interesting is the fact that it has, and I might be wrong about the interestingness of this, but it has BASIC chips in it. I don't think they all did. Like, I think that might actually be like a feature of this. So in the sort of expansion ROM area, they have several BASIC chips.
I'm not sure I ever encountered one that didn't have BASIC in it.
Okay.
I mean, before I worked at Epson, I used to sell these in retail also. And out of the box, I could swear one of the menu options when you powered it on was the BASIC interpreter. And I want to say that the BASIC was a flavor of Microsoft BASIC. That sounds familiar for some reason. Okay.
Well, if it turns out that they all had the BASIC chips, then that's not a super interesting selling point. But it does have extra ribbons. So maybe that's the selling point.
That's true. Two sealed extra ribbons. Also, you could get this and enter a particularly esoteric program into the 10-line BASIC competition.
Right. And then at that point, you would have run out of memory. But yeah, no, it's true. So it has a little printer and it has a little microcassette drive. And that actually, the spot where the microcassette drive is modular. I don't know what other modules can go in there, but you can take that out and put other things in it or other microcassette drives.
Tiny little disk drive.
Earl, do you know what other options fit in that spot?
I don't know what else you would put in that area on an HX20. I've only ever seen the microcassette drive.
I think I also have
or,
seen
or
that.
Nothing. There was a plastic blank that goes on there, or you can put the cassette drive in it. Was there some sort of a speech synthesizer or something like that for the HX20 that you could put in there?
Yeah, I think there's a side add-on. If I'm not mistaken, it doesn't go
well,
there.
There's a side expansion bay. Yeah. I've got that on my HX20, and it's got room for some extra goodies like ROMs and that, but I'm going to look it up while we're talking.
All right. Let's see. So the next thing I had, I just thought this was interesting. I don't know if you want to buy it, but it was interesting just as a thing that existed. I've seen it listed for a while. It is SoftGraph. Perhaps somebody out there or somebody in here has had some experience with this, but it's a software solution to basically fool your monochrome IBM PC into being able to display CGA stuff. It doesn't actually display colors, but it will, you know, at least run the software that required CGA.
I thought you were going to say it actually says it displays colors. I'm like, is this one of those punch a hole in the disk things? Right. Like, trust me, put this in, totally, and be color.
It's an interesting problem, you know, that this is a solution to. That, you know, there were things that you couldn't run because you needed a CGA card, and this is like a an emulator, I guess, of a sort. So it's just a disk, you know, it's just some sort of driver. But
oh, hey, Paul, just to retro back a little bit, you were right on that voice synthesizer. It apparently would go in the expansion unit for the HX20, that little sidecar thing off to the left. So I don't know what else you'd put in that microcassette area.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the microcassettes just broke all the time, and so this is just an easy way to swap it, but in and out. Okay, so the next thing I came across was, I don't know much about this at all, but it is a JR01 computer kit from 1972, and it is, I think it's basically just like a little analog computing device thing that you can make. I mean, like, it's all wires and plugs and things like that. You know, it's before the computers were at your home, and it actually seems to come with cards. So I think, like, one of the things you can do in the manual is create this little, like, card-playing game. it's for... Oh, yeah, here it is. Game number 14. So it shows you how to wire something up so that you can play something some game that you use cards with. And when I say cards, I mean, like, playing cards. Like, you know, things with suits and hearts and things on them. Very weird.
It completely is. It shows inside the book that comes with it, like, games you can play. And I read through, like, it has an open page, like, in game 14 is this game called Who Took What? And it's basically four people play it, three players and one person who is the computer operator who has to turn his back when everyone else is doing things because you're going to operate the computer, but the computer can't really do anything on its own, so you just have to not look. And all it is people, you stick these little matches, like little, they call them matches, little doodads to stick in these holes, and then everyone takes one out when you're not looking, and then you have to kind of deduce who's holding which one from what's missing from the hole. It's like the world's worst game. And that's game 14. It's super interesting, like entering stuff, and it's teaching you basically how to enter things in binary. And so very, very early, and I guess interesting, quasi-computer. But my goodness.
It calls itself a computer.
Well, I can call myself a lot of things.
Well, it comes with a six-sided die as well.
As most good computers do.
And I'd say
because you wouldn't want to have to calculate a random number.
The final photo that shows the top of the board, like, some of those little holes have gotten a lot of love. Like, this thing has been used. Like, someone has definitely put this thing through the paces. There's a lot of scraped away, you know, paint or whatever, or plastic, something that's just, like, very much been used.
But it's all scraped around the hole. So this was used by somebody who wanted to learn how to use computers, but had a lot of difficulty, clearly, with the concept of stick this peg in that hole. Not near that hole, or like bang it around the outside of it, but actually in
maybe
the hole. It's more like a stereo hookup.
Maybe they're like really excited. Like, they were so excited about the use of this computer. Ooh. They're like, oh boy, I got to slam this thing in that hole, and it kept missing all the time.
What I think is excited, the person who was excited who named this the JR01. Right. Not even just a one. We're going to have so many of these things, we got to number them in double digits to start with. This is going to take off.
The JR01 computer is more than a toy. It makes learning the principles of data processing easy and fun for all ages. Data processing.
Yeah, but you can say, like, a rock is all more than a toy. It's also a rock.
Right. Can double as a weapon. Anyway, okay. So I thought that was... I'd never seen, you know, that particular thing before. It's sort of like the predecessor to the Radio Shack's 90 and 1 units.
And I do like those electronics trainers. So while I mock this, I do have a sweet spot for this kind of thing.
So I don't know if this is interesting or not, but there have recently been a number of auctions that somebody basically seems to have come across a whole pile of these Thunder Mountain
high quality games.
Yeah, so, like, it's funny. So Thunder Mountain, the way I understood this, so the particular auction I'm linking to is a bunch of Commodore 64 stuff, but I've seen also ones for Apple, and I think they actually are from the same seller. But so Thunder Mountain was a company that basically, when major software companies went under or like decided they were going to stop selling something, Thunder Mountain would buy the rights to distribute the, you know, these titles in sort of like bargain versions, right? So they're generally these little 5 1/4 inch plastic things that hold like a disc and a miniature version of the manual, and like the, you know, they've got a kind of like a some version of the cover art. It's, they don't look that bad. Sometimes what they would do also is, you know, they would buy the right to distribute the thing. They would put their own new protection on it, you know, and then they would sell it. But the thing about these is that when I see these, I have a like a leftover reaction from the 80s of like, this is cheap garbage, you know, even though it's interesting historically in its own way. Like, I just can't quite get over the, like, the bargain bin aspect of this. I don't know if you guys have had a sort of experience with these or not, but these are interesting because there's so many of them. It's like such a complete kind of collection. So I can't quite get myself to want to get them because they feel like cheap knockoffs, even though they are, you know, like they were legitimately purchased and distributed, but the, you know, they're sort of like the second round when nobody really wanted these things anymore.
Right. Mm.
What media are these? It's tough to tell from the picture. Are these discs or cartridges?
Yeah, 5 1/4 inch discs.
Okay.
They must be. They look the same as the, like I have, you know, nowhere near this many, but I have, you know, a few of these for the Apple II.
So it must be a box that's just bigger than 5 1/4, because these are all very square. I see. So economically packaged.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, even at the time, they were the bargain things, you know. So you would get them for $10 or whatever. So if you're looking for, you know, a relatively complete collection, this seller has had a few. The Commodore ones sell for less. You know, this is like a $39 buy it now, which doesn't sound like a huge amount to me for however many that is. I mean, like, what is it? It's 4 × 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So 24. I guess there's that in the title. 24 games. But anyway, it's interesting to see the picture of them all together. Okay, next thing. Oh, this is the Sinclair ZX81 unassembled computer, sealed U.S. version. So this is rare on many dimensions. It is, first of all, for the U.S. The ZX81 didn't make it here, mostly. And it is unassembled, so it is a kit form. Looks really cool. I kind of hope nobody buys it and builds it, but there it is.
Well, so there's a question. If you had the dough and you buy this, do you build it? Otherwise, I mean, do you get it just as a collectible so that you can show folks what the kits look like? Or, you know, I'm not exactly sure what the use case would be for purchasing this. I don't know if you'd build it or not.
Yeah. I mean, kind of what I would hope would happen is, you know, it would be left. It would be documented. It would be, you know, extensively photographed and, but not built. It's a tough choice. I mean, like, it's not a choice I'm going to face because it's a $400 buy it now. But
right,
with a make offer.
That's true.
Make insult. Right.
Well, and I mean, this they're saying, you know, in a lot of these cases when they say rare, it's kind of like, but this is quite rare to find one still in the kit form.
I'm always been interested in that. So in North America, I think it was the case that what they came out as a Timex, right?
Sinclair.
It was the Timex. But often I hear, like in Canada, I don't know if it was different. Like as a kid, I had a ZX80, but I don't have any photographs of it. So I don't know whether it was just a Sinclair or Timex, whatever, because I thought the Timex ones only came with the 81. But 100%, the ZX80 was available in some form here in Toronto, Canada. Because as a kid, I had one. It was the little white one with the crazy flat thing, keyboard in front. I used it for all of like a weekend. It was terrible. Like even as a young kid, I was like, well, this is useless. but I had one. But I don't know whether it was a Timex or a Sinclair. Was it different in Canada than the U.S. because we have so many British things? Was it something that just was a pilot thing just here in Toronto? Was it across the country? I wonder if there's any other listeners in either in Canada or North America who have like kind of more knowledge of this. It's something I've always wondered. What the heck model was it that I would have had as a kid in Toronto that was white, not black? And I've always called it a ZX80 because that's my memory. But I don't know if I'm now remembering that that's what I called it or that's what it actually was. Like, for all I know, there was a knockoff in Canada of the ZX80, and I didn't even have a legit one. I had a, like, had a clone. I don't know.
But well, it was white, weren't the ZX80s kind of white with a blue?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, and that's my memory of it, but it's now been so long, I'm in that period of my life where I'm like, do I actually remember it accurately, or do I just remember my memory of it, remember my story of it? So I don't actually know. Like, how do I know anymore? How do I know that I'm actually on this podcast? I'm now going down a philosophical rabbit hole I got to get out of.
Yeah, if you're going to start asking existential questions, then we're going to have to change the name.
Yeah, but my memory is distinctly of it being the, you know, the white with the kind of many-tiered steps and the super, super flat part in the front. That, you know, way flatter than the ZX81, like the just flat membrane that's got a white border and black and blue keyboard. It was that thing I had hooked up to a television, and it was terrible. Because it was, the thing is, it wasn't my first computer. So you can imagine you've had other computers, and then you get this thing. It's like, well, no. What is this?
Yeah.
Well, if you want to relive the simplicity of a computer like that, and if you want to build it yourself, there are other options, because like Tynemouth Software, for instance, has the Minstrel ZX80 clone, and that you can get, I mean, with all the bells and whistles, the case, the keyboard, yada, 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 I think for probably below $200, and it's like brand new. All the pieces
are... The ZX80 isn't the kind of computer where bells and whistles should be plural. Like, at most, you would say it comes with a bell and a whistle. Because,
or a
like,
whistle.
Come on.
Yeah,
bell and or a whistle. Yeah, just or. It's definitely an exclusive or. It's like, I don't think so. Yeah, but you imagine, like, as a kid in the either late 70s or very early 80s or whenever it was, I would have got this. My dad, I think, came home with it. He was a sales dude sometimes, so I think he often would trade for things. So it probably came home as a trade. And if I found it not enticing back then, you can imagine like how dull it would be now. So no,
I remember
I
went to school with, either in junior high or early high school, talking about computers, and he was like, he's like, yeah, I have a computer at home. It's like some, it's some weird thing. It's like a kit that my dad put together, and he it was either a ZX80 or ZX81. And I remember his like whole opinion of it was very much that it was just not even like, he almost was embarrassed to talk about it, that it was like. So useless compared to any of the computer, like, because, you know, we all had 8-bit computers that were better than this. And he's just like, yeah, no, there's nothing I can do with it. It's not even worth it. I'm going to get something else.
Right. But, I mean, it was like a lot of Sinclair things. The whole point was, here's a computer and it's available for £100 right. or whatever. Like, so, like, it was a laudable idea, but not an actual good product.
I'm sure the ZX enthusiasts are, like, screaming at us right now, but I'll say that when I had a chance to poke around a little bit on one, it was minutes of fun. Yeah.
Again, Pearl?
Yeah, that's true. I think I've tested a couple, you know, just to show to myself that it, you know, it works, and I hit the keys to make the basic keywords come up, and then that's usually about it. But they were, you know, it was still an influential computer. So, mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. The next thing I was going to mention, Ian actually wrote in to point this out. It is a Compatacard 8-bit ISA floppy controller. And so essentially what it does is it lets you put this in your PC, and it lets you, it gives you access to like CPM disks and like it's a sort of like universal controller of a sort. That lets you plug in a bunch of other floppy drives. And it says in the article, in the description, I thought. The description doesn't say anything. That's weird. Did I make this up? But I thought, anyway, that this had been tested actually with a couple of different drives, and it was supposed to work. It's supposed to work with even an 8-inch drive, but...
Yeah, it says in the auction, tested with a bunch of different drives, other than 8-inch drives, because he didn't have any of those to test with.
Yep. When I refreshed, then I got it back. So, I don't know. It wasn't showing on my screen. But I'm glad I didn't just invent that. It really did, too. But, yeah. So, tested it with 360K, 720K, 1.2 megabyte, 1.44 megabyte drives all at once on a PCXD clone. So if you want to connect all of the floppies, you can do this with this card. Anyway, it seems like it's kind of an interesting item. All right, and then the last thing is, I thought this was kind of just a funny shirt. Somebody is selling their shirt. It's apparently from it's from the Windows 95 development team. They brought this on. They actually used this as a kind of an unofficial slogan. The slogan is Windows 95 sucks less, which I find very amusing. The story that I understand from this is that they actually sent somebody to like a Mac developers conference, and wearing a Windows shirt, and just to sort of like see, you know, to see what was going on and sort of talk to people and stuff like that. Somebody actually did say to them, well, you know, I'll at least grant you that Windows 95 sucks less. And they thought that was so delightful they had it made into shirts. So, and this is one of those shirts.
Cool. Fantastic.
Anyway, that's it. I've actually made it through all of the things I wrote down, and I didn't skip any. So sorry, everybody. Welcome to the second hour. No, third hour. Whatever it is. I'm ready to go to closing discussions. Are you?
Mm-hmm. Let's do it.
You start.
Okay, sure. In retro stuff, the only thing I've really done retro-wise recently is I finally went on. I had a little tiny bit of time, decided to game, not Infocom game, because currently the Infocom game we're playing for Eaten by a Grew at the moment is continuing to kick my butt. Or I don't know what it's doing to me, man, but it's really tough. So I took a break from that. And like a lot of people, I'll go on like good old games, GOG.com, and I buy far more games than I actually download and play. Like I just like, oh, I think I would like that game, so add it to my library. Someday in the future, when hypothetically I've got all this time, I'll actually play a game. And I suddenly had some time. So I picked not a vintage game, but a vintage style game that was out quite a while ago. A few years ago anyway, called Cathy Rain, which is a point and click adventure game in the style of an older point and click game. And it was nice in that it was a decent plot and you can play it in one setting, or one sitting. I just sat down in an afternoon with no walkthrough and was able to play a game to completion. And so that was nice. So it's a nice, easy adventure game that I'm actually happy that I played. So I would give it a recommendation. So Cathy Rain, available very, very cheaply on Steam and GOG and stuff.
Cool.
So I did that.
All right. Earl, what thoughts do you have?
I've been doing all kinds of retro things. Went to the local Commodore user group meeting a few days ago and met up with somebody that I had met at the Vintage Computer Festival Pacific Northwest, which was also a really great time. And I at that festival, I bought a device called an Easy Flash 3, which is a flash cartridge for the Commodore 64, and I don't know how I've lived without this for so long. It is amazing. It's not just a flash cartridge, but also has a USB port on it. You can get software to and from your Commodore and do all kinds of other fun things with it. Anyway, won't go into too much detail because I talk about it ad nauseum on the latest Chicken Lips that we recorded. So there's that. Also, I'm scanning like a maniac. So at one point I had dropped upon me a very, very large pile of DEC documentation. It's the condition of it is not good enough to keep like as a collectible for some of it, but it is good information. And so I've been going online to some of the usual haunts to see if that documentation is already scanned in good quality out on the internet. And if it is, then I'm recycling this stuff because, like I say, it's seen better days. But if it's not out on the internet, then I'm scanning it. I'm going to be upping it to the Internet Archive. So I got that going on. Luckily, I have a scanner with a document feeder, so I don't have to sit there one page at a time. Let me see what else. Just doing all kinds of other stuff, too. I dug out a Pentium laptop that I have and have been playing around with that and thinking about putting NT4 on there just to relive the good old days. NT4 sucked even less than Windows 95. Let me see what... All right, that's all I'll talk about for now. I've actually, the last month has just been retro heaven, which is kind of a nice change of pace.
Huh. Excellent.
Cool.
How about you, Jack, now that you're recovered?
I haven't done too much. I actually did sit and play some Atari 8-bit games today, just for the hell of it, for a little while. That was fun. But I haven't really been doing too much lately. I was thinking about the 10-bit basic contest, but it blew by me, as it usually does.
That's pretty severe constraints.
Yes.
A 10-bit's probably can't Do Wait, very much.
What did I say?
It's like one character.
I guess I'm still a little bit sick.
Yeah.
There's my program. It's the letter L.
Sorry to mock that, but I couldn't help it.
No, good catch. No, you know what I'm talking about. The 10 line.
Well, it's a bite with parody, though, so you can do more
there you go.
With that.
No, but otherwise, not too much going on here. I was so sick the past week. I was too sick to play games or anything. I was just like, I was just lying around, like a lump.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, you know, like, if you're sick and like, you decide you can't go to work or whatever, you also don't feel well enough to, like, do anything fun.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just unfair.
Right.
Let's see. It's been a long time, but yeah, I'm so buried in work and stuff, I just really have not had much time to do anything. Kevin Savitz did show up in town, and I ran into him at the People's Republic of Interactive Fiction meeting, which it was actually sort of funny because he tweeted, and his tweet was geotagged as being in Boston, and I'm like, what are you doing in Boston? Why are you why did you not tell me you were here? He mentioned that he was going to go to this thing, so I showed up there, and it was pretty interesting. I may try to go to future such things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's basically just a small group of interactive fiction enthusiasts that meet at MIT.
Right. So. Cool.
Nice.
And what else? Oh, I also noted I have watched a bit of TV, and there was a show that they were hyping for a while called Miracle Workers. I forget what channel it's on, TNT maybe, which has... you know, Harry Potter's in it. What's his name? The actor who plays Harry Potter.
Daniel Radcliffe.
Yes. And it's, you know, whatever. It's a goofy show. What is the premise? They're in sort of like the wish granting department, or no, I guess they call it prayer granting or whatever. So there's a challenge that they have to meet, or else, you know, the world's going to be destroyed. It doesn't really matter. But the tech in all of the office is all like super old. And so he's at one point, he's actually in several episodes, you can see it, but at one point he's like lugging a Capro 2 around and like setting it up to like do something, you know, from heaven. So if you wanted to see, it's, you know, it's an okay show, but it has some vintage tech in it. So it's...
I just looked it up on Wikipedia because I never heard of it before. And then the description for episode 1 opens as, God decides to blow up the earth and focus his efforts on a new restaurant. Like, okay, you might have already caught me hooked.
Yeah. It's pretty short, you know, like, so it's not a big commitment to watch the first season. So
Steve Buscemi is God.
Yeah.
And I noticed people have been cast as God's dad, God's mom, God's brother.
Yeah.
Okay. A lot of this is tickling.
It's a pretty funny premise, yeah. And that's about it. So, like, I guess I have plans to scan. I have, yeah.
You a plan to scan.
Boy, I'm so behind. I mean, like, in all of the things that are not in my retro life, I am so behind. So, I think I will first try to stay employed, and then after that, do some scanning. I think that's probably about it.
Cool.
So, that's it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at vcfed.org/forum/forum.php. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast, or at rcrpodcast. I don't know how you say that. You can join our Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/rcrpodcast, if you can deal with Facebook as a thing. Our Facebook group is good. Maybe the rest of Facebook is not, but whatever. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network, which is at throwbackreviews.com, at a link in the show notes. And perhaps write a review on iTunes if you want. And until next time,
Retro Compute!